trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny summer Davis day. Oh, Don, it is so lovely. It's got sunshine. It's got hummingbirds. It's got everything.
Sunny summer day. This is a very typical day here in Sacramento Valley. We're running about 5 degrees above average today. Average high temperature in July and August here is about 92, 93 degrees. Today's date is August 5th, 2026, recording the show for broadcast on August 6th, 2026. And today, Wednesday, is going to go up to 97 degrees. And tonight will be 60 degrees and clear with breeze coming in from the south. Thursday will be 99 degrees. This is for Davis proper. 99 degrees on Thursday. Thursday night will be 62 degrees. Friday heating up again for the weekend to about 101 Friday, 102 Saturday, and 101 again on Sunday with night temperatures 62 to 64 degrees each of those nights. Monday, going to drop down to 94 degrees, Monday night cooling off to about 59, and Tuesday 93 degrees. We are on the edge of a big old high pressure dome, whatever you want to call it. If you go to ventusky.com, this is a fun time to look at it. Back up and look at the entire United States map on there. Massive flow of warm air pushing in over the Four Corners region, all the way up over the Great Basin, Nevada, up into the Pacific Northwest, where they're having terrible, terrible fires and a lot of smoke. And if you then zoom in, we were talking about this a little bit last week, get closer to the San Francisco Bay Area, you see that coastal influence, thank goodness, pushing in a little harder for our side of the valley and cooling things off a bit. So last week, or well, a couple of days ago, it was quite warm. It was about 101 to 102 roughly in Davis. So 99 was what we got to at our place in Dixon. But I was on Weather Underground, which is a fun site because they have a bunch of weather stations that appear to be private stations scattered all over Davis. And some of them, one of them was 106. Most of them were 99 to 100. A couple were 102. So even within our area, your local neighborhood microclimate made a difference in terms of how extremely high we got during the peak period of temperature in the mid to late afternoon that day. Our only concern with this, and we're going to go back into the low hundreds again this coming weekend, so we're seeing a little bit of sunburn on two things, tomatoes and newly planted plants. Okay, two totally different categories, but we're seeing sunburn on them. In the case of tomatoes, any fruit that was getting close to ripe and was west-facing earlier this week, you start to see a sort of a burnishing yellow, lighter color on it. That's going to be injured if there's more direct sun on that particular fruit. That's the important part as we go again into 100-plus degree weather. So if your fruit is off of green, has gone into the color stage, picking it before an extremely hot afternoon, bring it in, setting it on the counter, it'll ripen in 2 to 3 days. If you leave it out on the plant, it's going to take 5 or 6 more days to ripen. Interesting fact, high temperatures slow down the ripening process. Mm. High temperatures can also cause direct injury to the fruit tissue, can literally scald the fruit. And that can become a source of bacterial entry into the plant, into the fruit, causing decay.
So what you're saying is that a tomato on the vine on the west side mm-hmm. is going to rot faster than the same tomato if you picked it off and put it on your counter in the kitchen.
It's going to be more likely to rot or to get damaged because although the direct injury from sun doesn't rot the fruit, it opens it up to decay yeah. organisms, which are always present. And it's going to take longer to ripen out there in the garden than it will on your counter at this point. So if it's close to full ripe and you're seeing that burnishing, that kind of lighter color, you're getting the beginning of sunscald. Oh. You can still use it even if it's sunscalded. It's not going to damage the flavor or anything like that, but you'll prevent further injury to that fruit, the fruit facing west.
That one particular fruit.
Or well, the 10 other or 20 reason, or whatever it is. I mean, maybe a whole bunch of them.
Yeah. Right. But the things on the east side aren't under danger from that, but they may be under danger from squirrels or rats or,
right. yeah, so or, there's all
or
of that.
Turkeys. Or, yeah. So anyway, if you all have tomatoes and they're looking sort of like they're starting to get red, Go ahead and pick them and eat them and have a wonderful time.
And they'll take 2 or 3 days more to ripen. One of my friends sent me a note saying my gypsy peppers aren't ripening. Is that heat related? Yes, gypsy, like all other sweet peppers, turns red when it's fully ripe. Most people eat them green, but they do ripen. And high temperatures above about 95 degrees roughly just essentially slows down or almost stops the ripening process on the plant. The plant goes into a different metabolic pathway and the fruit just stops. It's not completely stopped, but it's ripening much, much more slowly and more vulnerable to injury. Your peppers especially, by the way, your bell peppers, if you've gotten all this trouble to grow a bell pepper and it's facing west, it's exposed to that sun, you might want to pick that and bring it in and use it, either let it sit on the counter, maybe ripen, but more to the point, we typically use peppers green anyway. My experience with peppers, by the way, yes, you can pick them. Yes, like a tomato, they're a climacteric fruit that continues to ripen for a few days after you pick it, but they also start to desiccate. They start to lose moisture from the fruit itself. Well, your tomato is doing that to a degree, you probably don't notice it all that much, but with a pepper, it can wither to the point of being unappealing. So, but better just to go ahead and use it. And of course, we don't mind using peppers green anyway. Just be aware that there's a risk of sunburn on some fruit, particularly, I don't see it as much on eggplant, but peppers and tomatoes, you could get some sunburn on the fruit exposed to the hottest sun in the afternoon. It is worth noting, though, that proper irrigation reduces sunburn. Because sunburn is a function of the density of the coating on the fruit. And if a plant is drought stressed and people are backing off on their watering or they haven't been watering enough and now that's catching up to them because of the higher temperatures, that will increase the risk of sunburn. So when I see, for example, and this is, boy, a long circular way to get around to this, we're going to be hot this weekend. This would be a good time to give your whole vegetable garden and your fruit a really deep soaking. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, going into a higher temperature weekend. That's the way I prefer to do it because then I know I've given them 18 to 24 inch depth of irrigation. I don't have to run out there when it's 105 degrees with a hose to make sure every plant is getting what it needs. Just the other group of plants that are getting sunburn, which are the newly planted plants. So people
Isn't this where you have a tree or a new bush or something? You do a little whitewash on the side.
Painting the trunk is actually more typically done, interestingly, in the winter when you're planting a deciduous bare root fruit tree, something like that will tell you to whitewash or put a protective guard on the trunk. Generally, by this time of year, a fruit tree should have enough shade, enough foliage to shade its own trunk, though if it is exposed, it certainly wouldn't hurt to have that protective covering on there. I've gone over largely to trunk wraps, but you can certainly paint the trunk with white latex. So that's a possibility. I'm thinking more of the people who are coming in and buying a cart full of lavender and penstemon and salvia and some 6 packs of flowers and some 4-inch and quart pot things, and they're planting them out. They want advice on how to proceed. So I would suggest, one, wait for your own comfort till it's cooler at the end of the day or first thing in the morning. I prefer the end of the day. It's a nice time to do it. Water in when you plant it. Don't wait on that. That has to happen right away. So actually what I do now, since I have big area and I'm planting a tree like way out there, is the first part of the process, maybe even well ahead of time, I make sure there's a hose all the way out to where I'm going to be working. Not just for the plant, I may be watering myself in this weather, but more to the point, put the plant in, make the basin, water it thoroughly, wash off the leaves. I always do that. People say, why, you get the leaves wet in the direct sun? Yes, I always do that. I wash the leaves off. I water, I fill the basin. I then water around the basin.
On the outside of the rim.
Outside, right. And that goes for whether it's a 4-inch pot, a 1 gallon, a 5 gallon, a 15 gallon. I'm filling the basin. Then spending another 30 seconds or so just taking the hose and doing slow watering around the outside of the basin so the roots can penetrate out into that. And then what's the rule at the Davis Garden Show?
Check your plants. Check daily.
You have a t-shirt.
Water
that says
your
this.
Plants.
You have a t-shirt. You have a t-shirt from one of our listeners that
it says, check daily, water as needed.
Yeah. As needed. And it's not necessarily going to need it every day, although in very high temperatures, it might. Citrus that I planted 7 to 10 days ago have needed water every other day. They haven't needed it every day.
It hasn't been 100 and something either.
Been up and down. It's been all over the place. And that's normal here. We go back and forth. So check daily, water as needed. It's perfectly fine to plant during the summer. But if you under irrigate a plant that's been put in fairly recently, especially a plant with a shiny or waxy leaf coating, you're going to see some sunburn on that plant. It's not all that harmful, but it's not great, obviously. And I'm thinking of things like Pittosporum, of course, citrus, waxy leaf plants like that, almost any of them will burn. Other plants will respond to stress by withering, so that's obvious, but the sunburn is a transplant shock on certain types of plants. You know that KDRT is community radio? That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And usually at the beginning of the show, we do announcements. Got an announcement, Lois?
I do. Holler is going to be in the studio on Monday, August 10th at 6 p.m. Pacific time.
Holler? And who's Holler?
H-A-U-L-E-R.
Okay.
Holler. It's music done. It's music.
Thank you.
The California Sound is the program that's on Catered, and John Emery, Schiller, and Shorty will be there, and they will be welcoming Holler, and it'll be a program that's live in the studio. No, this is not an audience thing. You can't go down to the studio and be in the audience. That be wonderful? Monday, August 10th at 6 p.m., they'll be on the radio, and then they're going to have a CD release party on Saturday, August 15th in Orangevale. So if you want to get more information, they have a website, hollerband.com.
How do you spell Holler?
H-A-U-L-E-R, like Hall.
Like Hall, not like hollering at someone who's across.
No. H-A-U-L-E-R-B-A-N-D.
Okay. The Arboretum has a great event coming up here, Gardening for Wildlife. If you're interested in adapting your landscape to support local biodiversity, you can join the Arboretum and Public Gardens California Climate Action Corps Fellows for Gardening for Wildlife. More in-depth follow-up to our Climate Ready Gardening webinar. You can create a garden that supports native plants and wildlife, enhancing the beauty and resilience of your landscape. It's a free one-hour program. Fellows will discuss key principles for attracting and supporting native fauna, highlight featured plants from the newly revamped Arboretum All-Stars plant list, and share practical maintenance tips to help your garden thrive for years to come. RSVP is required for this webinar, so go to arboretum.ucdavis.edu, click on events, and that is the Gardening for Wildlife event, Tuesday, August 11th, 6 to 7 p.m.
All right. So now we have a message from Annie, who is again writing about tomatoes. Okay. Hello, Don and Lois, my treasured garden gurus. I need your expert, well-thought-out help, please. My tomatoes are not doing well this year. Okay. Unfortunately, I only have two raised beds, so I can't rotate my tomato plants as recommended. I always plant F1 hybrids, Early Girl and Sweet 100, except for Juliet, because I love those tomatoes so much. At this time last year, my plants were very healthy, and I had so many tomatoes that I was giving them away and canning tomato sauce. This year, all the plants except the Juliet seem to be failing. I live in San Rafael, Sunset Zone 16, and we did have untimely May rain this year. I do everything according to your recommendations, plant in late April and use the watering recommendations that Farmer Fred gave you for raised beds. I feed them monthly as directed with EB Stone organic tomato food. When the leaves started fading and yellowing, I took your advice and trimmed them off. Now more are yellowing, and they are further up the plants. The plants have not been thriving. The usual lines have not appeared on a regular basis. Photos attached. Is there anything I can do to save my sick plants from whatever illness this is? Please, please help me.
It doesn't actually look like an illness. That's the good news. It looks like it's a watering or nitrogen issue. And the reason I say that is I'm going through the three pictures that were sent. I see a spot on a leaf here and a spot on a leaf there, but I don't see the typical pattern of verticillium wilt or fusarium wilt or any of the blight type diseases. That's what I'm not seeing here. So that could be good news. From the looks of it, these plants got stressed 3 to 4 weeks ago and are not getting sufficient depth of irrigation. So try a periodic cycle of a really thorough, long irrigation. And it looks like when the older leaves are yellowing like this, that's typically a nitrogen deficiency. So I know you're fertilizing, but it may not have been effective, or it may have been something that just got used up or watered through or whatever. The source of nitrogen may not have been efficient. So that's what I'm mainly seeing here. I don't see a typical disease pattern. So when I'm looking at these pictures, when people send me their tomatoes in their garden, and this is great to actually see it in the setting rather than walking in with a yellow leaf. Yellow leaf doesn't tell me a whole lot. This setting, I'm not seeing one side of the plant yellowing or flagging. That would be fusarium wilt. Good news. That's one of the worst ones to deal with. I don't see that pattern here. I don't see the typical verticillium pattern where the plant is drooping and appears to need water even when you know it doesn't. I'm not seeing that. And the yellow wing pattern here is not the typical verticillium. So those are the two big ones that I wanted to kind of rule out just visually. No, I can't rule them out completely, but from this picture, that's not what I'm seeing. And the hybrids in general have good resistance to verticillium wilt, and most of them have reasonably good resistance to fusarium. So if you did VF hybrids or VFN hybrids, the N just refers to nematode tolerance, then you've got the verticillium with the V and the fusarium wilt with the F. You've got resistance to those to a degree. Fusarium is a tough one, and there are new strains of that in Yolo County, but I don't know that you're dealing with that. I think you're just dealing with an environmental and or soil nutrient issue here. That's the good news. I have found that every now and then, every 3-4 weeks, I turn the drip line on my vegetable garden, the part that goes to the tomatoes predominantly, and I run it as long as I'm running my orchard, which is 8 to 12 hours. It's a drip line, so putting water out slowly. I don't do this every time, but every now and then I'll do this. Invariably when I do it, the plants put on a little surge of growth. They respond with better turgor. In other words, they're telling me that I was keeping them just on the edge of drought stress, which is fine. Tomatoes will do okay with on the edge of drought stress, but they definitely respond to that deeper watering. So this is an easy diagnostic here. That's the first thing. If you're using a drip system, you're running it, let's say, Fred and I are recommending for raised planters, you need to run it daily, 30, 35, 45 minutes, depending on your soil. Every now and then, I would like you to turn it on all afternoon. If it's on a timer, you can just bypass the timer. Or if it's you can go to the valve and turn it on there. Or what I often do, if one plant isn't growing as vigorously as all the others on a particular line, I will drag a hose out to it and give it its own special watering. But see if the plants respond to that. And that'll tell me that you were kind of on the edge of drought with the current watering regimen that you have. The other thing is that for all of you, early August is a great time to side dress, as we use the term, for fertilizer, your tomatoes, your peppers, your eggplant, cucumbers, if they're still initiating new growth, and so on. You don't need to bother with your squash or pumpkins or anything like that. But generally speaking, the nightshade family and the others, side dress is a term we use for the way we apply dry fertilizer. So there's a bunch of other ways you can do this, but it is the middle of summer. In fact, looking at my calendar, hold on here. The 6th is Lugnasad. Lunasa.
It's what?
Lunasa, the exact middle of the summer. It's not the exact middle, but this is when it's celebrated. So this is the date of midsummer. Midsummer Night's Dream is very peculiar. It's set in June. That's the beginning of summer. Midsummer is August. We're at the middle of the season. The days are getting shorter, but it's still plenty warm here. Some plants are beginning to show the effects of shorter days. Some of them are showing the effects of drier soil because things have just dried out so much. We've got a whole nother cycle of production here in California. There's places where this would be the beginning of the winding down of the season. If you've got fruit on there, it better be, your tomatoes better be setting now because you're going to be done by mid-September. We go to mid to late October here. So if you can give everything a really deep soaking in the first week of August or the second week of August and a light side dressing for indeterminate tomatoes that are going to continue producing for you, you'll get another surge of growth, another bunch of blooms. And if the temperatures are low enough during that bloom period, and they will be off and on about 50% of the time here, you'll get fruit set and that good late September to mid-October crop. So this is a good time to side dress anyway. And I do think I see mostly the yellowing here is probably just a nitrogen deficiency. Whatever you're feeding with just wasn't quite enough for those plants. And the watering is not quite enough for those plants at one rather important time. Try that first before we get further down the rabbit hole of soil diseases or any other possible pathogens.
I'm looking at these pictures and I can't tell. Yeah, I can't tell from them whether or not the planter is sitting on that concrete slab or if the planter is sitting on soil.
Yeah, that's an important question, yes.
Yeah, so yeah. If it's sitting on that concrete slab, then the roots are very short.
And it's
if it's sitting on soil, then the tomato roots can go down 4 feet like they like to. So
there's kind of a series of questions we find ourselves needing to ask when someone walks in. I'm having trouble with my tomatoes, and they'll show you a picture of the fruit or the leaf, and we'll say, okay, first question, garden bed or raised planter? Okay, raised planter. If raised planter connected to soil, or sitting on your driveway or something. In other words, is there a soil connection with the soil, a root connection that can be made by the plant in there? If it's sitting on your driveway or something like that, then you're just growing this in a very large tub. That's fine. I've done that plenty of times just to see how it goes. And I can tell you by August, you're definitely going to need daily watering in a container if the roots can't get any further down. Tomato roots can go 4 to 5 feet or more deep and out, but they can't do that, obviously, if there's a barrier on the bottom. So conversations with people who are building raised planters or using raised planters because they have a problem with nut sedge or Bermuda grass or something, they're going to put a barrier down there to keep that from invading, in which case they're going to be growing their tomatoes and their vegetables in large containers. Be sure to run a drip line that has adequate distribution. So you want your emitters every 6 inches. You want 5 lines in a 4-foot bed, and you're going to water it every day, because by August, by Lugnasad, your plants will be root bound, and they're not going to get any less root bound as the season goes along. By the first week of August in the ground, the roots should be deep enough that you can deep water every few days with a conventional indeterminate tomato in our area, giving a bunch of gallons all at once, and that'll get you 4, 5, 6 days. Sometimes once a week is fine for people with good silty loam soils. So we do have to go through this, what's the root environment question, and raised planters have some special problems. And the biggest problem they have is that the soil you filled them with the first year loses organic material and loses nutrients steadily. And so you have to keep supplementing those, and people tend not to do that. You can supplement the nutrients with liquid fertilizers or dry fertilizer products, but in the long run, the best bet is to top dress the bed with an organic compost of some sort that has some added organic fertilizer. If you do that every spring and every fall, most people find they don't really have to use any supplemental feeding. But right now, first, second week of August, good time to side dress or give a special liquid feeding to your tomatoes and your peppers and your eggplant to keep them going. Okay.
So let's see what we've got for messages. Oh, here's a good one. Okay. This is from Josh. I love the titles that people put on their emails. This one says, Operation Hide the Blue Pop-Up. That's a good title. Hey, Davis Garden Brains, you've come through for me before. The Clematis Montana you all suggested is absolutely thriving, by the way.
Oh, cool.
So I'm back for round two. I need help extending my privacy screen a few more feet along the fence line. The main mission? Hiding the neighbor's electric blue pop-up canopy, which currently photobombs every single pool.
Look at this. A great picture, yeah.
And it's looking at the pictures, it's the very tippy top of the tent is a little bit higher than his fence. And so he's seeing this blue pyramid shaped thing up there.
Yeah.
Okay. So here we go. I went down the bamboo rabbit hole and it turned out to be more expensive than we thought. $800 for 2 15-gallon plants and a livestock trough. Apparently, that's just the going rate for fancy grass in a cow bathtub.
We'll come back to this one. Okay, go on.
Okay, here's the spot. North side of a fence angled to the southwest, so anything below the fence line gets zero sun in winter, but full afternoon sun in summer. A plant with range, basically. One more wrinkle. There's only about 1.5 feet between the stone path and the fence, yep. So it needs to be kept pretty slim. Okay. The ground rules. Nothing mounted on top of the fence, yeah. And no vines climbing on it, because that fence has been through enough. The bougainvillea already holding down that corner has bigger ambitions anyway. Yeah. The long-term plan is for it to climb the entire arbor. So I'm leaning towards upright shrubs or potted trees to fill in below. Maybe a fruitless olive to complement it. So what would you plant? Bonus points for fastish growers that can handle Davis summers. And then he has sent some pictures.
Yeah, this is one of those things. It's just right there. It's not ghastly ugly, but it is a dramatic shade of blue. And if it had popped up in my, behind my backyard, that certainly would be noticeable. My guess is this is seasonal, so it'll be there during the summertime. My guess is they're trying to shade something. So here's the first thought. If you happen to know this neighbor well enough to go over and say, hey, I'm just thinking of planting a small tree on this side of the fence. Just want to make sure, one, that won't overwhelm your yard. If this is your vegetable garden or something, let's not plant a giant tree. It'll be a problem, but they might benefit from it. If they're putting this up for shade, they might say, great, a tree would be wonderful. What are you thinking of? And there's lots of choices in that regard. Let's back up to the bamboo thing. Bamboo can make a quick screen, really quick, but doing it in the manner of getting an instant screen is rather pricey. Yes. So 2 15-gallon bamboo and a livestock trough. The trough itself, a couple hundred dollars of soil. To fill that, you want to use a good quality soil. So you're going to need a bunch of bags of potting soil, and that gets to another 100 or so, depending on how you do it. 15-gallon bamboo, just a very rough ballpark price on this, can be anywhere from $150 to $300 or more, depending on what kind it is, who you're buying it from, and so forth. The reason for buying a 15-gallon is it would give you a screen right away. I mean, we had a customer whose neighbor put in a three-story addition on practically on the property line. It wasn't three stories. It was two stories with a vaulted roof kind of thing that made it functionally like three stories. And the window looked straight down into their side. I mean, like right into the kitchen window from the upper story room that had been added on. They weren't mad, but it was weird to suddenly have this window like looking right into their kitchen. And in fact, the guy told me they had the neighbor over, come on over for a glass of wine. Let me show you what we're dealing with here. And they were, oh my God. Oh, we didn't think about this, you know, and people typically don't. They don't think about the impact of their screening or their remodel on the neighbors. So it was mutually agreed quickly that some kind of screen was necessary. But since there really wasn't much room, this is kind of like the side yard, 6 feet or so of space. They didn't really have room for a hedge per se. Definitely not room for a big old tree there. But they could put in a couple of deep livestock trough, deep but narrow. So 2 foot by 6 foot by 3 foot, something like that. And in each of those, they put 2 15-gallon bamboo. And literally, once it was installed, they had a screen that day. So that was the nice part of it. Yeah, they paid for it because there's a lot of soil and a lot of physical labor getting it in there and all that. But the 15-gallon gave them privacy immediately. We were helping them choose the type of bamboo. They liked that slightly see-through look of a running bamboo, like the grove effect. Even though you get less privacy from it, it's enough and it's really a more elegant look. So that's what they wanted. So if you're doing a running bamboo, definitely this is the way to do it because it's going in a pot. You lose interest in this project, you can just get rid of it. But the clumpers will also do the job and they'll give greater density. So if your privacy is what really matters, put in one of the non-running types of bamboo. More to the point, you don't have to start with a 15-gallon. Depends on how ugly this is to you. Because if you're patient and you put in a 5-gallon bamboo at this time of year, next year it'll send up shoots that'll get up as high as you want. The year after that, they'll leaf out and you'll have the privacy you're after. So it'll be 2 years instead of one to get the privacy that you're after. If you don't mind waiting, that's one option. And in the period in which you're waiting, you could do like a temporary fence extension with a fast-growing vine that's just something you're growing for a year or two. Hardenbergia is one, the happy wanderer, or some annual vine that you just plant from seed, or hops work very well. I mean, just temporary, quick summer cover. Hops, by the way, are very attractive too, so that's certainly a direction you might want to go. But you said no vines, so that would just be a temporary thing in this particular case. So the bamboo is still an option. It's just that you happen to jump to the most expensive remedy by going with the bigger ones right away. $800 sounds about right for a big bamboo from a bamboo specialist in a livestock trough with a bunch of nice soil. That sounds about right. But you don't have to jump to that size right away.
And do you have to put it in a livestock trough if it's not a run? If it's not a runner, can you just put it in the ground?
You can, but each of them get 5 to 6 feet across, and they are doing that by slowly expanding outward. So this is an important thing to know about bamboo. All bamboo has rhizomes. All grasses essentially have rhizomes. The question is, how far does the rhizome go before the next culm comes up? In the case of a runner, like the old-fashioned black bamboo or the golden bamboo, Phyllostachys nigra, Phyllostachys aurea, it'll send a runner out 5, 7, 10 feet in one season, and then along that runner, that rhizome, up will pop bamboo shoots every couple feet. So that's how you get that see-through effect, the bamboo forest look. But that also means 5, 7, 10 feet in a single season. 5 years from now, how far has that gone? If it has the adequate moisture, it can go quite far. Clumping bamboos have rhizomes. They may only go 2 inches before the new culm comes up. They terminate in a new culm, a new shoot, as opposed to the others, which continue running and then the shoots form behind them. So a very old 30-year-old Bambusa textilis on my property, it's the tight clumping bamboo, very rich soil, plenty of water. My plant has gotten about 5 to 6 feet across at the base. It fans out 15 to 20 feet wall of bamboo. I mean, it's one of the best ones for privacy. Bambusa textilis, weaver's bamboo, is great for this purpose, but it's 6 feet across at the base. So I don't think he has room for a clumping bamboo there because it would push under the fence and freak out the neighbor. I guarantee clumping bamboos don't run, but it's really hard to persuade people of that. So he would have a very large plant. Clumping bamboos are not invasive in the sense, even locally invasive. They're not garden thugs, but they're big plants. Even the smallest types get pretty big across at the base. But the three that I recommend for privacy, depending on the height you're after in our area, Eddie Goodell, which is a dwarf, so-called, that in our area is topping out about 7 to 8 feet, so a little above the fence height. It would do the job here if he wanted. It would take a little while. Bambusa textilis, 25 to 30 feet, big wall of bamboo, but again, a tight clump. And then in between.
But very wide.
Well, it fans out. So they come up and then they arch outward very gracefully. So yeah, it makes one clump of that. Well, I've had people plant it to screen off an apartment building, did a great job. And then in between that is Alphonse Carr, which is a golden striped one that gets about 12 feet in this area, much taller in the American Southeast. So if you're listening down there, Alphonse Carr gets 30 to 40 feet for you guys. Here it's 12 feet, 15 feet, and a nice tight clumper. Those are all non-running bamboos, but we'll move on to other options.
So I have two things to say. One is, I know that your poor little fence can't sustain yet another line.
Not a heavy one.
However, there's nothing that says you couldn't take a couple of post hole diggers and dig a couple of posts and put a what do they call those things? It's not really a trellis. It's a
lattice.
Arbor or something.
Well, it depends on whether.
Anyway, and then run a vine on that. Yeah. And that way you would be able to get the cover you wanted fairly quickly. And it wouldn't hurt your fence.
Yeah, there are annual vines. I mean, I've got scarlet runner beans in my vegetable garden right now climbing up an obelisk, and they're about 10 feet high, and they've got there very quickly, and they're very pretty. It's a fairly open screening. There are vines that'll do the job much more quickly, like the annual morning glory, but I do not recommend that one. I have a big patch of that. I have a big patch of it in my vegetable garden in a place I carefully chose so that if need be, I can rototill all around it, get all the seedlings out. It's beautiful. Morning glory is indeed glorious in the morning. You go out there and there are flowers are open, they're glowing because of sunlight hitting the flower. It's quite stunning. If you have the place for morning glory, fine. No, I'm not recommending it in this setting. But there are vines that will cover quickly, temporarily. I mentioned the Hardenbergia violacea, happy wanderer. I think in the nursery trade, we need to start telling people this is a 5 to 7 year plant. They just seem to die out after that period of time. By the way, that's fine for most people. It's gotten really vigorous and bushy in that time, and they're trying to figure out how to prune it. The answer is cut it to the ground and, you know, start over. But it does a very good job right away. It grows very quickly. It doesn't need a heavy support. So I know you said no vines, but that's one possibility, is something like that that would just be temporary while you're waiting for the bigger plant to grow up. If you go to redwoodbarn.com, you will find a list of small to medium trees. And I find myself printing out versions of this list very, very commonly. This is becoming one of our top categories, certainly that we're answering questions about in terms of shade trees. And then you quickly realize these are small yards and they don't have room for what we think of as a shade tree, you know, 40 by 40 foot oak or something like that. They do want some shade. They want some privacy. They want a bunch of different characteristics, but they don't have room for anything that's going to say block solar panels, shade the neighbor's yard. So we're typically looking at 10 to 15 foot trees. Although in most cases, they're more like shrubs that we're pretending are trees. Here's the key question. Could you put one in the ground there? Go ahead and take a look at that list, and I think you'll find it useful. And then it'll get you going in the direction of whether there's a tree that will fit in your particular situation. And just scrolling down here, I see Arbutus marina. It's a big tree, but it's well-mannered, so it wouldn't particularly bother your neighbors all that much. I see olives, of course, and you would definitely want a fruitless or mostly fruitless type in that situation. Podocarpus is being used, is very popular for these purposes, and it will take sun. It's just a pretty big plant. It's something that you might find a little overwhelming to your neighbors. So you might want to check with them on how big a tree is okay with them. I really wish more people would do this. You're planting a tree that's going to have an impact on your neighbor's yard. You know, you might mention that I'm planting a 12 to 15 foot tree here. Is that okay? I know that most of us consider it our property, but the impact we have on our neighbor's gardens would be nice to consider at times. But the podocarpus is certainly a possibility in there. And I see a whole lot of other small flowering trees, most of which are deciduous, but even a deciduous tree will give you privacy. And I'm guessing they'll probably take this thing down in the winter because they wouldn't need the shade at that point. So maybe it won't bother you then anyway. Two others I see on the list, pineapple guava, feijoa, and then Loris nobilis, the male clone. Actually, it's a hybrid. It's not nobilis, Loris hybrid, Saratoga Bay. Those are two evergreens that would give you what you're after. The feijoa gives you flowers that are edible, fruit that's edible, if you happen to like that. And then the Saratoga Bay is very clean because it's a male cultivar, so it doesn't get the fruit that we sometimes get on the Grecian Bay Laurel. Nice round-headed tree, very well-mannered. The only question is there room there to plant a tree that ultimately is going to have a trunk, you know, a couple feet, a couple 1 to 2 foot diameter trunk over many, many years. You'll find some other deciduous things that I think would work well. Vitex, the chaste tree, although again, deciduous, it would be there during the summer, giving bright blue flowers as we go into late June and July, and nice leafy green foliage, more of a shrub than a tree, but can be trained up like a tree. And one that I'll come back to so often here because of how versatile it is xylosma. The shiny xylosma, which is widely used as a shrub, is also grown as a tree. We have one grower who stakes it up, tops it like a lollipop. We suggest to people you let it grow out more naturally, but xylosma can be trained as a tree, and you can buy one in a 15-gallon already above the fence height. So you'd be buying something that at least visually would give you a barrier, and within a year or two would probably block that thing entirely. And that's the kind of thing where if your neighbor doesn't really want a tree, it can be pruned by you. It can be pruned by them to keep it for size control, to keep it under, say, 12 to 15 feet with no problem. With one annual pruning, you could do that. That's just ornamentals. And there are things like citrus that, of course, would do the job as well. They would just take a lot longer to get up there. We had a customer come in during a heat wave, the one we had a couple weeks ago, very high temperature, middle of the afternoon. And he was looking for a tree to put in a pot to shade something, which is an interesting idea. I appreciate this direct approach. I need shade. I need a tree. I need it now. But no place in the ground to plant it. So that was an interesting conversation because he was looking at what we had at the back of the nursery was a really nice walnut tree. So he just saw this nice walnut tree and he thought, that would do it. Can I grow this in a pot? Well, that's an interesting question. Of course you can, for some period of time, grow anything in a container. You can grow anything in a pot if you provide it with what it needs in the way of moisture and nutrients. And I can tell you, you can grow a tree in a container. No problem. It'll get root bound typically by the second summer. Root bound meaning it's needing water more often. So any tree, regardless of what it is, in a container will ultimately need water probably daily here. That's fine. And it will stunt the tree naturally to be kept in a container with its roots confined. That's also fine, as long as you understand that this is not a sustainable project. He wasn't looking for something that was going to grow in that spot forever in a container. He wanted shade right now. Okay, fine. Go out and buy a walnut tree and put it in a pot. Walnut wouldn't be my first choice, but I could see why he liked it. It had some branching already. It already looked like a little tree. And so his key question was, can I do this and get shade immediately? You can get some shade from a tree in a container, but the bigger the container, the better. So if you're going to do this and it's going to be something you don't think you're going to be able to put in the ground anytime soon, half barrel would hold it for 2 years, and you'd be watering daily by the second full summer. A livestock trough, the advantage of them, you can get them much bigger. You can get them 3 to 4 foot diameter where they hold 2 to 3 times the soil volume of a barrel, even bigger than that if you want to, in which case you could keep it in there for several years. So you could do for a long time, you could grow a tree in a container, just understanding that you're going to run out of options at some point. You're going to run out. You can't put it in a bigger container because there isn't one. So you either put it in the ground or you just scrap the project. But for 5, 6, 7 years, if the container is big enough, it won't be that challenging. As long as you have a way to provide water on a regular basis, simplest thing to do is run a drip line off of an existing irrigation system, like your lawn sprinklers, run it up into the planter, have it watering that 2 to 3 times a week, probably fine. Smaller container would probably need it daily. That's the problem. Something will happen. You go away for a week, your water is off, that tree is going to die. It doesn't have anything to tap into because it's locked in a container. Nutrients are another issue. And so you either top dress the nursery soil that's in there with fresh nursery soil each season to get something in there that has nutrients, or you just feed it regularly with some kind of fertilizer, whatever is convenient for you. Slow release resin-coated fertilizer like Osmocote, organic fertilizer scratched into the top at the beginning of the growing season, liquid fertilizer, whatever works, but you're going to need to do that because whatever soil you put it in there initially will run out of nutrients within probably one growing season. So plant a tree in a container, temporary, sure. The ones that seem to work really well, olives. great for this purpose. They're just very tough. They go without water. They don't die right away. So you have a little bit of a margin of error with them. And they can be lovely trees in containers for many, many years. And people don't seem to mind having them root bound, stunted technically, but still providing the aesthetic value that you're after. And bay trees, bay laurel, Laurus nobilis, is traditionally done this way as well, as are many forms of citrus. And some of them would get tall enough, even in a very large container, to provide the screening that you're after. In the case of the first two, olives and bay trees, you can buy big ones. 15 gallons already going to be up there. The grower will have trained it up above fence height and topped it so you have a nice round lollipop kind of shape. You'll let that grow out, but more to the point, it's already up there to begin with. Harder to get citrus that size because citrus demand always exceeds supply. So finding a big specimen citrus could be more challenging, but it'll grow up there eventually if that's the direction you want to go.
So, Don, I have a question about growing a tree on a patio. If I were to take one of my indoor trees, I'm thinking of the Ficus benjamina.
Sure.
Would that work in a pot on a patio?
Sure. I know lots of people who put them outside for the summer and oftentimes end up leaving them outside in the winter in a sheltered location because Ficus benjamina in particular, the weeping Chinese banyan, is reasonably cold hardy. It can go down close to freezing here. And if you have a microclimate, which you typically do, sheltered next to the house, it'll get through that. I had one out for years until we had the big freeze back in 1990 and that killed it. But that was extremely cold and very unusually cold for our area. We knew it was happening. We had plenty of warning when that cold air mass was moving in. So it would have been a good time if I really cared about it to wrestle that ficus at least into the laundry room or something or the garage for the duration of the cold. But yeah, something like a ficus can be outside and can be, it's honestly a lot easier to care for them outdoors than indoors. And then they just come back in before we get very cold. Or you'd be aware that there's always a risk in zone 9A or 9B of winter injury on those types of plants.
Even if a tree isn't evergreen, some of them have enough branches up there that even after their leaves are gone, they would still block something in the distance, wouldn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, I mean, to say, first of all, my guess is this thing is probably not present during the summer since it's a shade structure of some sort. It might be out there, but not necessarily. But there's plenty of plants that have sufficient density even when they're out of leaf. Weeping mulberry, weeping cherries, first of all, they make an accent that draws your eye, even if there's something behind them that you might see, the plant itself becomes a real accent plant. And there's sufficient density. I mean, if you've ever grown one of these weeping mulberries, it's a fascinating puzzle of branches. It becomes a real puzzle when you try to figure out how to prune them. That's a different conversation, but it definitely is dense enough to give some privacy even without leaves. So some of these smaller trees would be sufficient. Evergreens, obviously, are going to be better choices in this situation. There's a bottle brush, for example, Callistemon, that has the name Slim. He mentioned he wanted slim growth habit. Well, there is this bottle brush. It's a variant of the regular red flowered bottle brush that just has a strongly upright growth habit. And I brought some in when they first came on the market. In the container, you can see this thing is like a column. It does fan out a bit more, but the growth habit is very, what's that word? Fastidiate. And so it has that, gives that privacy quickly. And this is selling reasonably well for a lot of nurseries because we're always looking for the plant that provides that screening, the hedge plant. And there's a tendency to just overuse certain things. I've got nothing against red-tipped photinia, but there are millions of them planted in the United States because it became very popular in the 1960s. Didn't have the problems of certain other hedge plants, so it started getting sold like crazy. And of course, when we sell one thing a lot, some problem will show up. Powdery mildew on the new growth, leaf spot diseases, and of course, fire blight can hit photinia. So a lot of people planting photinia started getting dieback problems or leaf disease problems. So people would shift to xylosma or feijoa or privets or any of a number of other plants. Oleanders became very popular for these purposes. As we like to say on the Davis Garden Show, if you're planting a hedge, it's better to plant a mix of species, always true, than a single thing all the way down. This is a case where a single plant is what we're after. So that strongly upright growth habit would be useful. But you might, if you do choose a plant for this, just from a design standpoint, want to repeat that. So let's say you do the Callistemon Slim right where it matters, which is to block this blue thing. Well, now you're going to have a rather strongly upright plant there. And generally, from a design standpoint, repeating strong vertical elements is considered desirable, and then softening them with more rounded elements. That's just a basic thing of landscape design right there. So repeating the slim Callistemon, two of them or three of them down the fence, not like a hedge, but just to repeat that growth habit, and then breaking it up with something with a more rounded habit in between can give you a nicer look overall and give you the privacy that you're after. That's just a design suggestion.
If we're still talking about Josh's situation,
yes.
But there's the neighbor's yard, then there's the fence, then there's that 2 foot wide planting area, yeah. And then there's this structure. That is eventually going to be covered with those bright red flowers. Mm-hmm. So the bougainvillea, that's what it is. So I would think that it would make sense to plant something green, like mm-hmm. those elasma, mm-hmm. so that even when the vines take over and are in front of it, it won't conflict. You won't have something covering up that vertical line you were talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, get a mix of vegetation type, but also look at the growth habit of the plant. And these strongly vertical plants are very useful, like Italian cypress, you know, the one we think of as a cemetery plant. Straight row of those is pretty weird to me. Taking them and grouping them and having things in that have a different growth habit actually makes them look more natural. That's kind of the look we're after here. What I would do, go get to know your neighbor and give them a nice 15-gallon clementine mandarin and ask them to plant it right on their side of the fence so that you both get the benefits of the fruit. 3 or 4 years down the road, that'll be providing the privacy you all would benefit from as well. The problem with a lot of these new subdivisions, I don't know exactly where he is, but we're seeing this a lot with a couple of the new housing subdivisions in town. 2 feet of space between the lawn or whatever and the fence isn't really enough room to plant most things. Yeah. I wish we could get this message across to builders in particular, or maybe it's the landscape architects that work for them. 4 feet minimum, please, if you're going to be planting any kind of shrubs or small trees. 6 feet would be better. If that reduces the lawn area, great. I don't see there's a problem there. But the key thing is 2 feet of space next to a lawn in particular, that whole bed is essentially being watered with the lawn. So you have to choose your plants according to that. It's not enough room for anything that has a trunk to develop or anything that has any natural spread to it to develop. So you end up creating these situations. I see these pictures all the time where they're pruning constantly because the shrub is crowding whatever, the deck or the path or the lawn. And it would have been better if they just left 4 feet of space or at least have the bed widen out so it's not a straight line 2 foot bed all the way down. That's a really hard thing to change after the fact. It's a hassle. Let's put it that way. It's a hassle to change after the fact, but pretty easy for the builder, landscape architect, to provide a better landscape opportunity for the buyer of the house. Too late for you unless you're ready to reconfigure things. So let's look for things that'll fit in a narrow bed. Things in containers, temporary, but that would do the job. That's one option. But you could look at some of these large shrubs, small trees, especially those that have an upright growth habit. I'm going to throw one more in here. Italian buckthorn. Rhamnus alternus. It's closely related to our native ceanothus, which is very fussy about drainage. Italian buckthorn is kind of fussy about drainage, but there's a cultivar called John Edward, which is resistant, they say, to Phytophthora, resistant to crown rot. Fast growing, strongly upright, clean. You can buy one in a 5 gallon that's already, say, 4 feet tall. Some growers even stake them because they're sometimes used as small trees, especially in the Bay Area. Once established, this, I have one that I don't water at all. On my property, there's natural rainfall is all it ever receives. For the first 10 years or so, I did water it. And one of the things I'll notice about this one is that anytime I walk by, little songbirds are going into it because I'm walking in that direction. So they're getting away from me by zipping into the Italian buckthorn. And there are little fruit in there that you never notice. It's a little tiny fruit berry, I think. I haven't even looked close.
It's like the xylosma fruit. It's so small. The birds know.
We don't see them, but the birds see them, and they seem to like the fruit. And the cover and the flowers are small, not significant, but they draw beneficial. And so it's just this big background plant that I think should be used more as an alternative to, let's say, privet, photinia, or other plants that have been overplanted. Italian buckthorn, Rhamnus alternus. Do crown it up a little bit when you plant it so water drains away from the crown. That'll be true for anything there, but especially for that particular plant.
So Don usually sends me pretty pictures of beautiful flowers, and then sometimes he does something like this. This is citrus leaves. They don't look like citrus leaves to me. They're all curled up and distorted and funny looking. And aren't they awfully light green for a citrus leaf?
That's the new growth on clementines, which is paler green than the older leaves. And that's true of a lot of citrus, that the new growth is brighter green, most of them actually. And they were, all my citrus, my young trees are flushing out beautifully. We've had very mild weather here up until within the last week or so. It's been either below average high temperatures or just right within average. Very few very high temperature spells and almost no north wind episodes. So all the new growth of my young trees has been pushing out just great. Then we got very hot with very low humidity. I've often been trying to figure out exactly when the curling and cupping of citrus leaves occurs, because people will bring me samples, of course, year round. You can walk out and look at your tree and see these buckled, curled leaves. And first thing we would say, you know, look under the leaf for aphids, things like that. But this is very common on perfectly healthy citrus in this area. I have lots of citrus trees. Almost all of them have leaves on them that you could find that have this curling, this distortion. The leaf edges aren't perfectly smooth. They've been buckled or cupped a bit. This is when it happens, is when we have high temperature and low humidity. That's the primary cause of this leaf buckling and distortion on the new growth of citrus in my observation. So in my situation, that's number one. Number two is thrips, Western flower thrips, which are a native insect in this area that will attack the new growth of citrus. Not much to do about that one, but you can tell that one by a slightly scurfier leaf appearance. Something's actually been feeding on them a little bit. They will cause this to some degree, but most of what I see is weather related.
And the thrips would go one leaf here and one leaf there. They wouldn't hit every single leaf, would they?
They would
50 leaves here.
Right, and you've got 1,000 thrips. So that's what happens.
Oh.
Just move in en masse. So a good point is that it's like an all-at-once thing, and it really takes people by surprise. We're seeing thrips damage on marigolds, dahlias. They look like spider mites, but it's actually thrips injury on those. And that occurs. So there's some of that going on out there. But the other thing is the citrus leaf miner, 2 weeks ago, started showing up in a big way. Third week of July is pretty typical for that. I always mark it down because I'm just curious as to how it varies from year to year. Typically, end of July, early August, it hit hard last week. I mean, every leaf on some of my citrus, every new leaf is gotten a leaf miner in it. And they don't go into the older leaves. They can't. They can't oviposit on the waxed over heavier leaves. But on the new tender growth, which I have a lot of on there, tons of leaf miner on there, causing the leaves to fold in on themselves to some degree. If they get into a leaf that's expanding, it won't expand correctly. So it doesn't look perfect. It just looks, again, buckled and distorted. So all at the same time, we have this temperature and low humidity phenomenon, some thrips injury, and then citrus leaf miner adding to it. People keep wanting to know almost every day, what do we do about the citrus leaf miner? And the answer is nothing. There's nothing to do, nor is there anything to really worry about. Yes, it's distorting the leaves so they won't look perfect, but they're still photosynthesizing. They'll be full size. It doesn't stunt the tree in any shape, form, or manner. It doesn't attack the fruit in any way. It doesn't attack the blossoms in any way. So it doesn't hurt really at all, except for this distortion of the new growth. But the I want to do something people want to know, can I squish it? Sure. Find that little train track and leave, squeeze it. Sure. Should I pick off the leaves? Well, picking off the leaves, that leaf is photosynthesizing. So clearly the leaf miner is not hurting the plant. Picking off the leaves would marginally. Yeah. So there's no real point in that. Is there an insecticide? No, it's in the leaf. So the only insecticide hypothetically you could use would be a systemic. That would be an odd reason to use a systemic. And anything you spray on the surface of the leaf isn't going to kill it. So sprays for the leaf miner have focused on spraying to kill the adult, which of course was there a couple of weeks ago. There are multiple generations. So people who are really concerned about this, coastal growers of lemons and limes, for example, where it hits earlier, does a lot more distortion of the growth. They're concerned it might affect their orchards. They will spray typically with something like spinosad, starting sometime May to June, based on trapping with pheromone traps, and spray about every 2 weeks all through the rest of the summer. Now, spinosad is a organic insecticide, but is a broad spectrum insecticide. That means it kills anything you spray it on. So, you know, even though it's organic, it kills bees. So you don't spray this when they would be present. Well, they're not present now. Okay, fine. But we don't want to do it unless there's a reason. And you'd be having to do it all that often to try to kill the adults with not absolute guarantee that you're going to get the timing just right. That's where the pheromone traps are useful. For those of you growing lemons in an orchard in the Bay Area, you probably already know this, but you can get pheromone traps from Monterey Chemical Company, put them out there. Once the adult shows up in the traps, you start spraying. Home gardeners, you don't need to spray. Washing off the plant won't do anything. They're in the leaf. So they just run their course and they're kind of interesting. And Some years are worse than others. One year they didn't even show up until almost October. I was looking at my old notes. More commonly, it's about the 1st of August. And boy, yeah, they sure hit hard over the last 2 weeks.
Someone walked into Don's store and said, I see that all your Meyer lemons are labeled, quote, improved Meyer, unquote. What does that mean?
It means that the Meyer lemon you were buying is virus-free. They have taken the propagation stock, the budwood, the green stuff that you would graft on to a rootstock or root directly, depending on how you're doing it, and they index it, which is a funny term, not sure where it comes from, to eliminate a particular virus complex that came in and devastated the Meyer lemon industry in California in the 20th century. And so this particular disease was in the plants. So if you went to take budwood from this plant and graft it to a new plant, you're just carrying it from plant to plant. The only way you can stop something like that from happening is for the state to take regulatory action. First, we had the virus indexing, where you take that budwood and you heat it, you cook it just hot enough to kill the virus, but not kill the budwood. Then they passed a law that you could only, by law, sell Meyer lemons that were improved Meyer in the sense of being virus indexed. So a retailer like myself can't sell anything else. They didn't change the Meyer lemon in doing it, except to get the virus out of it.
So Don does send me beautiful pictures of close-ups of flowers and just gorgeous stuff. Today, he didn't. He sent me a distant glimpse of his sign at the Redwood Barn Nursery on Fifth Street. Yeah. And at the base of it is an entire bed with Rudbeckia. It's very pretty. It's called Brown-Eyed Susan, right?
This one is Brown-Eyed Susan. This is Rudbeckia Fulgens Goldsturm, which has moved its way rapidly up onto my top 10 perennials list. This planting, in front of my business, right under the sign, it's about 10 feet long, I think, that's just slowly filled itself up. Most Rudbeckias that you plant are black-eyed Susans, Rudbeckia hirta, are biennial. So you go to a nursery right now and you buy them coming into bloom. Enjoy that bloom, because there's a pretty good chance they're done at that point. They are technically short-lived perennials, so I don't rip them out when they're done blooming. I will deadhead them, or I'll just go ahead and cut them back at the end of the season. Sometimes they'll send up a side shoot and bloom a second year, but they're not definitely not functionally perennials. Rudbeckia fulgens, different species than Rudbeckia hirta, is a long-lived perennial that spreads by short underground rhizomes. And we put in 2, 3, 4 of them out here out front of the nursery probably 8 or 10 years ago, and they've spread slowly down the sidewalk. Every year at the end of July, they come into bloom, and they bloom all the way into the middle part of September. And it only gets about 24 inches, 18 to 24 inches. It's a brown-eyed Susan as opposed to the black-eyed Susan. Most people wouldn't know the difference, but it's a different species. Very, very easy to grow. So this is right up there with Midnight Penstemon and Salvia amistad. I've got a list of like 10 top foolproof perennials. This is definitely in there for your mid to late summer bloom, a time of year that can be challenging. One of the first articles I wrote years ago when I was first asked by the enterprise to write articles for them was about the doldrums in August, the slow time of year in the garden, because it's hot, it's dusty, your weeds are growing like crazy, and there aren't that many things that bloom nicely at that time of year here in the Sacramento Valley. Well, this does. And the Zauchneria is beginning to bloom. And that Penstemon Midnight might still be blooming. Amistad Salvia definitely blooming right on through the summer. But this one in particular gives that great August bloom. Brown-Eyed Susan, Rudbeckia Fulgens Goldsturm.
Well, Dick Raymond says, there are always newer, easier, and better ways to grow a good garden. And I've spent a lifetime trying to find them.
He's a great garden writer. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.